Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. There are clearly many, many downsides of this crisis, but one of them is not getting to see and interact with our colleagues. And I know that we've all done such a great job using Zoom and other platforms to try to stay connected, but it really isn't the same, especially when it comes to saying goodbye to colleagues that we've gotten to know and work with. And that's been the case with a number of our European colleagues whose tours have come to an end and have had to go back home and end their time in Washington. And this is coming up for one of the ambassadors that I've gotten to know and work with quite a bit, Ambassador Kristi Kauppi from Finland. And so we thought we would take this time and record an episode focused on talking to the ambassador, maybe allowing her to reflect a little bit on her time in Washington, D.C., and just to send her off in style, Brussels sprout style. So, Ambassador, thanks for taking the time. I know you don't leave till July, but we wanted to be sure that we had the opportunity to get you before you go. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Jim. It's great to be with you, even if it is only virtually.
By way of background, Ambassador Kauppi has been here in the United States since September 2015, so coming up on 5 years, really. But she's also had a long and impressive career in the Finnish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, holding a number of posts. She was the Director General of Political Affairs, the Director General for Africa and the Middle East, Ambassador to Austria, DC, in Berlin, and on and on and on. So she's had an incredibly distinguished career in the Foreign Service. And so, Ambassador Kauppi, one of the things we were talking about before we jumped online is just how this crisis, how COVID has influenced and impacted the life of an ambassador. I mean, how has this affected what you have done, what you do on a daily basis, and all of the kind of hiccups and complications in doing the job that you were sent here to do?
Well, the immediate impact has been quite big, in the sense that I would say that normally about maybe 60% of my time, or even more, 60-70% of my time is spent outside of the embassy, basically meeting people, discussing, participating in different events, and traveling. And of course, all of that is now basically impossible. Well, some virtual meetings are taking place, but it's not the same. So it's been a big, big adjustment. So I'm spending more time actually basically with my staff now. It's online and virtually, but that has been the biggest change. Sort of 60% of my job is now basically impossible to accomplish in the fashion I would normally do it. And I'm spending that time with my staff, but also planning ahead, because we usually try to do the change of ambassador in a very organized fashion. So we try to plan together how to do the handing over, and that is taking some time.
Have you found any different ways to try to keep your pulse on what's happening? I think you were mentioning maybe even spending more time on social media, but how have you and some of your other colleagues kind of looked for other creative solutions to try to keep your pulse on what's happening here?
Well, following events is not that difficult. Actually, you have all kinds of sources, but the job of the ambassador is to get beyond the surface and try to analyze, and also try to, I would say, influence the events. It's very important to try to bring to the discussion your point of view, the point of view of your country, and in my case also the point of view of the EU. And of course that takes usually place in the person-to-person discussions and participating in different events. So what we are all doing is trying to have a little bit of phone diplomacy. from the embassy, myself and my staff at the embassy, who are, by the way, extremely active people. And we are also trying to build a little bit more phone diplomacy and virtual diplomacy between Helsinki and Washington. So that is what we are doing. But obviously, there are a lot of connections that you cannot actually do virtually. And especially the more sort of confidential discussions where you try to get to the background and you try to compare notes on your policy objectives, that's much more difficult virtually.
Well, for me, just to jump in, Andrea, sorry. you know, first of all, I want to also echo Andrea. It's a great honor to have you on here. And we did want to get you on Brussels Sprouts early because we know that your dance card is going to be very full. With all kinds of farewells for you as you depart. And I will say your embassy really has set the pace in Washington in terms of engagement, whether it's in the media, whether it's just on the diplomatic circuit. You're the Finnish voice is a loud one, and the influence here, a very positive one in Washington. And we know a lot of that is due to your leadership and your predecessors too. They built a great embassy here. And so we'll be sorry to see you go, but it's a real feather in your cap, I think. The job and all that's been done here that you've done through the embassy. And I'll miss you on a personal basis. We used to get together for breakfast pretty often just to kind of reflect on Washington and what was happening. And I've lost 10 pounds already because I haven't been able to go to those breakfasts. No. But anyway, if I could say, you know, during this COVID time, in terms of the Nordic countries, it's been interesting the amount of press that has been not just on Sweden, which of course has its own approach to handling the coronavirus, but Finland as well. Denmark was in there, Norway, and it's been an interesting insight, I think, for a lot of Americans who don't necessarily follow the Nordic countries as closely as we do, an insight on how those societies have dealt with this coronavirus. And of course, people are comparing that to Southern Europe, and we know that there's now potentially tension between North and South in Europe within the EU as nations have had to deal with this crisis in their own way. Would you like to talk about that a little bit, just the Nordic way on the one hand, and then how that plays out in Europe?
Well, as you said, we do have a little bit of different approaches between the Nordic countries, but I think the differences are actually not as great as it seems, if you read the media reports. We are also comparing notes all the time, and there are a lot of discussions between the governments and institutions about how to make sure that our approaches are similar in key areas, because we are very much connected between the Nordic countries, and it's important that we don't have two different approaches when you are talking about sort of the everyday life. Of course, the situation changes all the time. So in a sense, the other Nordic countries are now opening up the economy, and we are probably getting more to the same place where Sweden has been regarding how the society operates. I think as far as Finland is concerned, we followed for some time the situation and the examples in other countries, not only in Europe but also in Asia, how they are reacting. And then the government took a decision. In the Finnish case, it's very much government-led. So that's maybe the biggest difference between Sweden and, I think, the other Nordic countries. Even if the government in Finland and the other Nordic countries listens to the experts, the government is responsible and in charge. In Sweden, the expert of officials and institutions have a big responsibility and basically take the decisions. In the Finnish case, we have been able to contain the virus now to some extent, but of course when opening up there are the risks increase again. We hope to keep it under check, and we are of course very much also looking into opening the European space, the single market there, and because that's very important. The economic side of things is very important. Health, the most important, the economic side then. We were hopeful that some of our sort of traditional approaches to preparedness would have helped us in managing this crisis. But I have to say that this crisis has been something so out of the ordinary and the scale and the speed that the preparedness system that we have in place did not help very far. But it is something that we resort to, in the sense that there is a system whereby different agencies coordinate, and that has maybe made it a little bit easier. I think also in all the Nordic countries, what is special is that we have high level of trust between the population and the government and the different institutions. So that helps, especially in this situation when you start to open up, because you don't have to resort to very sort of robust measures. People understand and believe if they are given recommendations. So that's one thing. As far as the European situation is concerned, obviously everybody is very shocked about what has happened. We are to some extent only in the start of this crisis as far as the economic side of things is concerned, and it's very understandable that people are bitter and they look for somebody to blame. And to some extent we did not succeed in the European Union, especially in the first phases, and it's understandable that in some countries the population feels let down by the European partners. But I think the EU has improved a lot in its response, and now I think we are really, really getting our act together, not only as far as the health crisis is concerned, but also the economic side of things.
Maybe just to follow up right on that point about the EU, I mean, there were some kind of dire predictions right out of the gate about what the pandemic might mean for the European Union. And people talked about the way that this was aggravating and amplifying some of these pre-existing kind of fissures and divisions within the European Union. So I wonder, but I love your point about the fact that the European Union might have been slow out of the gates, but it's coming along in a way that hopefully will allow it to ride and weather the storm. And I mean, ultimately, you know, the goal would be that we end up in a better place than we were before the pandemic. That might be too rosy of a prediction at this point. But I'd love to hear from you just about what how you think the EU will ride this out. What are the couple of things that you're most concerned and worried about? And do you see any kind of glimmers of hope that this could kind of start to move in a far more positive trajectory than we saw in the early days?
I am hopeful and quite confident that the EU will come out of this crisis stronger. And of course, I cannot guarantee that, but I think in the end, people understand that even if it's quite legitimate to be disappointed and there's a lot of hardship that is still coming, But still, in the end, I think people understand that we are stronger together. And when we see the economic crisis increasing, and that is unavoidable, I think, still, I think people do realize that if we start to split up in Europe and basically lose the single market, for instance, nobody's going to win and nobody's going to get out of the crisis quicker. So I believe quite a lot in the common sense of people. There is a shock, there's a disappointment now, and there will be more shocks now. It was health. It is going to be much more in the economic side. But I think common sense will prevail. What is important is that the European Union also tries to be very active in the international scene. This is a global crisis. It's a global health crisis. It's a global economic crisis. And we need global solutions, global institutions, multilateral cooperation. And the EU is taking quite a strong approach in that sense and in those issues. And I think that's extremely important.
One of the things we've talked about on this podcast and in some of the work that we've been doing in our program has focused on European reactions to China. And, you know, that seems like that there are also some divisions here about how people are interpreting China's actions in the aftermath of the pandemic. And I wonder, what does that look like from Finland? How is that narrative playing out there? Is that even a focal point or kind of a line of discussion, or is that kind of just much more in the background than we make it out to be here in Washington?
I think in Finland, and I think in Europe in general, everybody is very much focused on the crisis at hand. So even if there are a lot of question marks, and there is, it's very clear that we will have to investigate what exactly happened in order to improve the international systems. The focus is very much on the crisis at hand, and I think that is sort of the general feeling in Europe. This is what we have to focus upon, and also start the investigations, reviews, and whatnot as far as how the international system has functioned, including, of course, also the role of China, and that will be something that we will have to do and is important to do, because without lessons learned, we will not be able to improve our preparedness internationally, and we will have to do that. I think China and the understanding of what kind of a player China is, that is again something that is changing all the time. But in general, I would say that as far as the Europeans are concerned, the strategy that the European Union put together about a year ago regarding China is in some aspects still very much valid. And if you remember, that strategy identified China in different roles as far as Europe is concerned. China is a partner and needs to be a partner in some areas. China is a competitor and a very sort of strong competitor in some areas. And China is a systemic challenger in some areas. So all of those three sort of dimensions are still there. Now, the balance may shift with events and, of course, depends on the actions of China. But I would say that is still very much the basis as far as how Europeans look at China.
You know, that's really interesting about China. And usually with Andrea and myself here at CNAS, you couple China with Russia. And so I'll take one of Andrea's favorite topics and ask you about Russia. And I asked you that as particularly as a neighbor. You know, we've been watching through the media Russia deal with the pandemic, and you can, you know, certainly understand where Putin, what Putin is doing. It's a lot of it we're not certain about. What are we really seeing? Is something being hidden? But as a neighbor, if Finland as a neighbor who knows the Russians quite well, what are you all seeing from Helsinki as you look across your border at Russia, not just Putin, but Russia as a nation and how they're handling this pandemic?
Well, I think this pandemic has been a huge shock for Russia, as it has been for other countries. And it's too early to say, I think, how Russia will come out of this crisis, both the health crisis and the economic crisis, and I would say also partially a sort of a social challenge, as we see in many other countries as well, maybe even political challenge. I think it is too early to say. For us, obviously, Russia is our big neighbor, and it is going to stay there as our neighbor. So you have to take into account whatever happens there. What we are trying, obviously, Russia has been developing into a direction that we are worried about, concerned about, and we have all been reacting to that, including with sanctions and with different kinds of other policy measures. But it is still a neighbor for us, and it's a great power. So we all have to also take into account. And again, like with China, try to cooperate where we can and where Russia's input is needed, and keeping a dialogue and then pushing back on issues where we disagree. One way of trying to again have a little bit of a more sort of nuanced approach to not only China or Russia, but maybe also our own strengths, Europe and US, is to look at, I would say, four different areas or dimensions of, I would say, power. There is security, there is economy, there is technology, and then there is normative power. And I think we can analyze China, Russia, other players as far as these four different qualities of power are concerned. But what is even more important is that we look at ourselves and try to strengthen our security, strengthen our economy, strengthen our technological abilities, and strengthen our normative power. So that is the way we in Finland try to look at not only our own country, but also at the EU and at the transatlantic relationship, strengthening our own abilities and capabilities.
I love that point, and you went in the exact direction that I wanted to go to, which is to the transatlantic relationship. And I know all in our transatlantic community believe so wholeheartedly in the importance of a strong transatlantic relationship, particularly when we're confronted with actors like Russia and China. But there's a lot of strain, a lot of stress in the transatlantic relationship. Some people have argued that COVID has, further stressed and already strained relationship. And I guess when you look out, one, do you think that's true? Do you think that COVID has been an additional stressor on this relationship? And I guess as you look out, where do you think this transatlantic relationship is headed? I mean, it's been such a rocky road. And I wonder if they're, again, looking for those little grains of hope, if there's anything in this pandemic that you think could help revitalize the relationship, or just given the political will, particularly in Washington at this moment, if we're not going to be able to kind of seize on that opportunity to turn things around?
I love history, and if you look at the history of the transatlantic relationship, there have been a lot of ups and downs, and it never stays the same. So the notion that it would somehow we would somehow always come back to some kind of a very rosy relationship, I think it is basically false. The relationship changes, and it has its ups and downs. As far as where we stand now, yes, to some extent, the COVID crisis sort of at least highlighted the fact that we were not acting together or in a synchronized fashion. And that was, of course, a failure and a weakness. But again, taking into consideration the nature of this extraordinary challenge, especially the speed and the unknown qualities, I think it is also understandable what happened. So the big question is, how do we go forward? And I would say that it would be extremely important that we are more synchronized and more coordinated, not only between Europe and US, but also with many other major allies and partners, but also with those with whom we disagree on, especially building back or improving the international systems and preparedness and so on, so that and I think in that sense this pandemic could actually be a catalyst for increased cooperation. It will not be easy, but it could be a catalyst because everybody understands that this will not be the last pandemic. So we will have to do something better together. One area where we hope in the big picture, this could also be a wake-up call, and that is the climate issues and what we call in Europe green growth. And obviously these are issues that are, you know, controversial here in the US, they are controversial in Europe, but I think this crisis has touched some nerve of sort of vulnerability in our societies and in ordinary people. And everybody is thinking about, well, if this was the case, the whole world was stopped because of a pandemic, what could be the next big crisis? And I think the climate is the obvious one. And if you think about the climate, it's also clear that there's not going to be a vaccine. If the climate crisis goes too far, it's irreversible. So I hope, and we hope in Finland, and I think also more generally in Europe, that this global crisis will at some point focus everybody's attention to the climate issue.
That's, I think a lot of us in the US hope that too. And I think you're seeing that in the presidential campaign. And I think if there's a change in the White House in November, I think climate is gonna be at the very top, or at least number two. But let me ask you, Ambassador, a question. And for Andrea, this is not my last famous last question. This is the second to famous last question, but it's gonna sound like it a little bit. Ambassador, you need to be diplomatic, but just to ask. So, you know, I think for Americans, certainly over the past couple of months, we've seen some things that have surprised us, or maybe it shouldn't have surprised us, but it dismayed us to see it. One of them, of course, was the famous storming of the State House in Michigan by these armed, I'm not sure who they were, who took over the State House. You've seen examples of tremendous cooperation and tremendous good things, things of Americans being quite humane and wonderful to one another. You see probably more of that than anything. But you also see a side that is dismaying in various ways. You see flaws and fissures and problems in our society, not just among peoples, but structures too. How does it appear to you sitting there here in Washington in the residence, and you see this kind of this spectacle unfold over the past couple months? What occurs to you about that? How does that strike you personally as you see that?
Well, I think all our societies are in some kind of an inflection point. I mean, not just a point, but this is a time when some fundamental things in our society are changing. And I believe that one of the drivers of this change, which is which means also that there's a lot of uncertainty, a little bit of chaos. You don't see the same old sort of dynamics in your society. I think one of the big drivers is the so-called information space, the media, the social media, the way people participate in the discussion and express their opinions. And this is a new situation. We are in a new world, in a sense, because of the social media and the way the information space functions. This has happened before in our societies, all the societies in the world, with different kinds of media. So I recently read a book where they were describing how, for instance, when photography was introduced, was something new in the 19th century, there was a lot of discussion how this is going to change the attitudes of people, and they will feel much more united, and they will understand each other because they see pictures of each other. And this kind of hopeful attitude has happened with each and every sort of new media outlet. I mean, radio, television, and now internet and social media. And in all of these cases, yes, the media has increased the connections, the possibility to understand what happens on the other side of the world, but it has also brought to the surface some new forces and changed the dynamics of the society. And I think this is what is happening everywhere. And it's sort of, it feels chaotic, but I believe that we are, sooner or later, we will have to, and we will come to a more, let's say, stable situation as societies. So I believe very strongly on that. But of course, since in a democratic society, there are two important issues in a democratic society in order for it to function well. It's the institutions, and it's a well-informed general public. So I think as far as both of these are concerned, we are seeing sort of this is a time of turbulence. And it's the same in Europe, it's same everywhere. And but I'm quite confident that we will come out to a more stable period as societies, because we will get used to this new information space. We will work stronger in order to ensure both resilient institutions and sort of a well-grounded general public. So I'm hopeful.
I know Andrea has a question, but just to make a remark, you what you said about technology reminded me, and photographs reminded me of a, I read something from a British diplomat back in the 1920s, I was reading his memoirs, and at the very end, he lamented radio. He said radio has now become very popular and everyone has a radio box. And that radio is going to dominate our politics and separate us as as peoples within the United Kingdom. And so that was radio. But anyway, Andrea.
Yeah, I think just to maybe for moving into a final question or two, but just to pick up on that theme, I mean, you've been here now in Washington, D.C. for 5 years. A tremendous amount has changed over those 5 years. I know you came in the wake of Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, so that sea change had already happened. But still, there's been so much that's changed. And I don't know if you've started to reflect on what your kind of final cable will be when you pull together all of your wise insights from your time here. But what do you think, if you know, what are some of the more notable things that you think have changed in the United States during your tenure?
That's a very difficult one, but because change is always something that, you know, has long roots, even if it happens abruptly, but it has long roots. And I think what I'm trying to do, maybe more than tracking the change that has happened, there are a lot of excellent books and articles and analysis about what is the change that has happened. What we at the embassy and all diplomats are trying to understand, where does this come from? So what are the drivers of these changes, which might then help us to understand where is it going, where is the US going? And of course, then we have a certain interest in let's say, at least making sure that not only the decision makers, but also the ordinary people in the US perhaps understand our point of view, and that sort of, that we could somehow bring something to their reflection and decision making that we think is relevant for not only us, but the United States and the world at large. So I'm afraid that's let's say the task that we have given ourselves, and it's a very difficult task, and we are probably going to be wrong in many senses. But just to say maybe two things. One of the things is the transatlantic relationship. That is something obviously where we try to understand what are the undercurrents and how can you maybe have an impact on those undercurrents, and is there something that is missing in the American discussion or discourse that we think would be important as far as the transatlantic relationship is concerned. The other one is international cooperation, and obviously that is again something where you know, despite of all the disappointments, it would be so important to try and improve and reform and make sure that we are not losing these platforms that we will need. So that's the thrust of that will be also the thrust of my final report from here, sort of trying to look ahead, trying to identify some of the undercurrents, and trying to look ahead and looking at the areas where we feel or I feel it would be important to try and build cooperation and try and build better dialogue.
Just one quick follow-up, Jim, and I don't know if you want to ask your final question, Jim, but just on that though, I mean, with the pandemic, you know, a lot of the news and a lot of the analysis is about kind of deglobalization, decoupling, delinking supply chains, propping up kind of local domestic economic firms. I mean, I think it was the cover of The Last Economist was kind of goodbye to globalization. And so the two things that you're talking about, a strong transatlantic partnership and multilateral cooperation, rest on a belief that governments are going to be willing to engage with allies and partners and in the international community and view international organizations as effective. So how concerned are you that this crisis is going to really kind of roll back, you know, where we've been and really change the trajectory of those things as you're looking out forward and trying to understand where it's all headed?
I think it is very clear that there will be some repatriation of certain supply chains, and every country, I think, including the EU as a whole, is looking at security of supply, the critical sectors in your as far as your national security, thinking about security in broader terms, are concerned. I think that is going to happen, and that is probably unavoidable and probably also prudent. And but the big question is whether this is going to be done in a systematic and sort of systematic fashion, or whether somehow there's a panic reaction and decoupling or repatriation is encouraged further than what I just described. I think, and we believe in Finland, that globalization is there to stay, and globalization is the foundation of our prosperity and also security. So if this turning of the wheel of globalization goes too far, we are all going to lose. Our prosperity and security is going to be hit. And so it's very much about, you know, calibrating the actual actions, but also trying to then get in the discussion to a more informed level, and sort of bringing this discussion to as I said, a more informed level. Yes, this pandemic is going to have an impact in that sense, and globalization is going to be rolled back in some senses, but we believe firmly that globalization stays as the foundation of international economy and also, as I said, security. So that's the way we see it.
So this has been really great. I've enjoyed it so much, and Andrea always gives me but she lets me ask the last question, which I try to make it a one of reflection of your time here. And so it's kind of in two parts. First part is, did you arrive in Washington from your last post with some preconceived notions or expectations about the United States and what you would find here in Washington as an ambassador, you know, working with colleagues from other embassies here, or just the country, as you've gone around to so many parts of the United States and seen so much of it, were you surprised that some of what you thought you'd see wasn't here? Or did other things surprise you to find out that you didn't know existed was here? That's the first thing. And the second thing is just, and Andrea has gotten to this somewhat, but as you get on the plane at Dulles to fly to Geneva for your next post, what do you take away from your experience here? What's your feeling about being the ambassador to the United States? So two parts.
Thank you. Very difficult questions, but as far as the preconceived notions is concerned, I suppose in a sense, I served here 20 years ago, so I knew the country a little bit, and I have always followed what happens in the States, like everybody in Finland and Europe does. And I love history. I've read a lot about history. I've I've been working with Americans in all my posts. I had relatives here. So this was not a foreign country to me in a sense. And by the way, I think that's a great, great asset of the United States. Each and in each and every country in the world, you have basically a lot of people who feel like they know you and have a special relationship with this country. So it's a huge asset. I think one negative aspect that surprised me when I compare with the time 20 years ago was that these sort of divisions and the polarization had gone so much further in comparison to that time. And that has been something that has been sort of something new. However, I have to say that we see the same thing in many other countries, in Europe, in many other countries. And have being a history buff, I know that this is, the country has been divided before. So, but to see it sort of in the everyday news and so on, that was different from 20 years ago. The other thing that always strikes me in this country is the fact that this is so vibrant and so dynamic. There is such a lot of diversity in each and every respect, and so that is always sort of something really striking and impressive. I think this country and the people are very, very impressive in as far as what I described, and this gives me a lot of cause for optimism. I think this country is a strong country, and the people and the institutions are strong. Being an ambassador, Finnish ambassador to the US, it has been a humbling experience because it's a very difficult job, and you can never do enough, and you feel a lot of responsibility. But I have to say that it has also been so rewarding. Each and every day, each and every meeting, the sort of the inspiring discussions with you too, and everybody else. I mean, this has been the time of my life. And being basically in the center of so many things, it's something quite extraordinary. I've learned a lot, and it's been great. I'm happy to go back home to Europe, and it's very interesting. I believe you two who have been abroad, when you are away from home, and for me, Europe is home, you learn such a lot about not only the country where you are, but you learn a lot about your home.
Right.
And it's wonderful to go back, and I will try to do my bit in Geneva in the about 20 different UN organizations and other organizations to keep the transatlantic flag flying high. So thank you.
Well, thank you. That's marvelous. Marvelous way to end.
Yes, that was fantastic, Ambassador. Thanks so much for taking the time. And we're so glad we were able to catch you before you go. We clearly wish we could send you off in person, but we wish you really the best of luck with your next post in Geneva. And we're looking forward to having the opportunity to work with you again, of course. So thank you for everything that you've done here.
And we'll make sure you get your Brussels sprouts mug. Don't worry.
Absolutely. Yeah, we will find a way to get that to you.
That'll be in your luggage as you get on the plane.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for being great friends and colleagues, and thanks to everybody who listens to this podcast. It's been a great time, and I'm very grateful that I had this possibility. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.